Hello there, I'm Tim and he's John and this is How to Murder Time, a podcast about games and things.
Hello everybody.
Watcher.
It's another What We're Playing show, isn't it?
Yeah, let's do one of those.
Do you want to start with what you've been playing?
Yes. Oh, this is brilliant. Like, for weeks and weeks and weeks, you've been banging on about the our games art and walking simulators and stuff. And I finally played Dear Esther.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, I called your bluff. You gave me that big list of our games art type short specials that you think I should play because I'm some kind of gaming philistine who just likes blowing up tanks.
And, yeah, that's a fair point.
And so now I've played it. I set aside, I thought, oh, blimey, this is going to be a job, isn't it? So I set aside the whole weekend to play it.
First mistake.
Yeah, an hour and a half later, I was done. It's quite short, isn't it?
Very short,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, sort of following on from our discussion of our game's too short and is game length important and stuff. I'd have to actually sort of revise probably a lot of my opinions from that show now and say, yes, it's far too short. I don't know. I'm really not sure what to make of it. I mean, yeah, I know we've been dying to have this proper conversation about our game's art and what is Dear Esther and so on since, like, forever, because
yeah.
I've never actually played the damn thing, and I've had all sorts of preconceptions and notions about what it was and how important it all is. You know, it's is this art and all the rest of it. I don't know how to approach it, really, topic-wise. I suppose, well, so presenting it in terms of my own experience, you play possibly a bloke who's possibly on an island that's possibly in the Hebrides, and you start on a wharf next to a lighthouse, and there's a bit of monologue, which essentially is a chap who's it sounded like was it Colin Firth or Robert Bathurst? I don't know who the guy is. I should probably look it up, but it sounds very similar, that kind of style and accent and narration anyway. But essentially reading a letter to dear, yeah, it starts Dear Esther and off he goes. He's basically reading out and I'm trying to work out what's going on there. Is this narrative relevant to what's going on the island?
That's a good question.
Is this narrative even actually a letter, or is it weird whimsical stream of consciousness stuff? It really does. I mean, magic realism, is that a term that's relevant to this? I have a lot of trouble, because the thing is, when I approach this kind of thing, I tend to sort of approach it as if it were a missed game, or as if it were a sort of ontological mystery, and the whole point of it for me, well, this is it. For starters, I'm looking for a point, I'm looking for an objective, and that's probably my big first mistake. But I'm all the way through, I'm sort of looking for meaning, looking to try and understand, to click, to put it together, to try and guess what the whoever's created this thing is trying to convey, and you know, is there some clever thing? And I'm obviously looking for the clever twist as well. And so basically, you start on the island and you sort of potter around in this abandoned lighthouse thing. It looks vaguely like some kind of, I don't know, sort of far outer Hebridean island that's somewhere in Scotland that's sort of been abandoned since the 1800s or whatever. There's a few buildings about the place, but there's not a lot else, really. There's no things, really. There's no people. There's no entities of any sort. Well, I don't know. Exactly. You can ask, is that really what you think about anything in this game?
Did you not notice that sometimes there are people?
Oh, in the distance. Sometimes you see a silhouette, and by the time you get there, they're gone, obviously. Yeah. Yes, I did notice that as I was going through. There's a lot of writing on the walls, and obviously right in the lighthouse at the start there's these big loads and loads of cans of luminous paint, and obviously that then gets used throughout the island by whoever was there before you to write various things and draw various scribbles and diagrams around the place and writing along the edges of cliffs and so on. In terms of gameplay, you really don't have a lot of agency at all, and you know, I'm sure we'll get to the big question at the end, but so you can walk about, you cannot sprint, you cannot, no, there is no sprint button, there is no run fast or crawl or crouch or any of the normal, because if you come into this like an ignorant philistine like I am, having played almost any first-person shooter game with story elements and expecting this to be something similar, and you find that you cannot jump, you cannot run, you cannot sprint, you can walk at a single defined pace in the direction you point by pushing W, you can strafe left and right and walk backwards, and you can turn first-person mouse look controls. Yeah. Using the left mouse button makes you zoom in a little bit in the direction you're pointing.
Ever so slightly.
And nothing else. And the right mouse button's nothing else. There's no keyboard commands, no tab, no inventory, no objectives list. Push escape gives you the options. The options basically contain things like hardware, resolution and sound, you know, that kind of thing. And
yeah, nothing meaningful.
It doesn't even have a load or save game particularly. It's such a minimalist experience that I really have trouble working out if this is, you know, is this a game at all? And So you basically, off you go across the island, and you climb up some cliffs, you wander around some sort of moorland areas, there's some coastal bits, there's some caves you go through, those are quite nicely done. It's a very atmospheric game. I mean, you know, but I wonder about this whole use of the term walking simulator.
Yes.
Right, so we got this, you know, so because, you know, we're special people who are gamers who like to categorise things and everything. Everything in its box, and we can't function with ambiguity, and we don't like double meanings or no meanings at all. So everything needs to belong somewhere. And so the gaming public at large, by which I mean people who bother filling in tags on Steam, seem to have dumped this in a category which it has come to define, called the walking simulator.
Yeah.
And you've used this terminology on the show, so have I.
Do you want to know a secret?
Yeah.
Out of all the big ones,
yeah,
this is the only one that really is a walking simulator.
But it's not even that. That's the point. It's in no sense is it a walking simulator. What I would expect a walking simulator, because I was assuming all sorts of things about this game, but what I would expect a walking simulator to be is, to be honest, something more like a Bethesda game. You know, Skyrim Fallout. Okay, yes, there's combat and there's magic and there's plot and all the rest of it and people to talk to and innkeepers and whatever. But at its core, what people seem to like about the current style of large-scale Bethesda open world game is the wandering around a really well realized 3D environment, the moorlands and so on. And to be honest, Skyrim is much more of a walking simulator than Dear Esther is in any real sense. But Dear Esther's relatively old, I think. I mean,
it's quite old, but it just got another release on PS4 because you've got to re-release everything on console.
Well, yeah,
save for Skyrim. Actually,
I've seen better countryside in other games. The thing with Dear Esther is it does a lot of trickery and in Horizons and stuff. You're always in valleys. You're rarely ever on the tops of hills.
It should be said that Dear Esther was absolutely stunning when it released.
It looked to me and has the feel of a Half-Life 2 mod. Was that where it originated?
Yes.
Yeah, the engine seems...
It
has
that
look and feel, the UI, although, the save game, the low points.
Although the new ones have been moved to Unreal, I believe.
I suppose, well, whatever. I mean, that's just nuts and bolts, really, at the end of the day. But it is... It's not really a walking simulator because it's so, so linear.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no freedom of movement in any real sense. You walk forward along the path. Sometimes the path forks and you can go left or right and they both end up in the same place. They more or less run parallel to each other. So there's no meaningful choice at all. You can choose to move forward or you can choose to stand still. That's essentially your entire... I mean, you know, you choose the rate at which this essentially, I don't know, cinema piece, performance art, whatever you want to call it, mixed media. It unfolds itself on you at the speed it wants to, and you walk forwards, and when you get to certain places, bits of monologue trigger. You know, the narrator carries on with his letter and his musings and so on, and that, I suppose, forms whatever kind of narrative, whatever kind of story there. And desperate and looking for objectives and meaning, I've come to really latch onto that as the... Yeah. Right, well, now I need to uncover all this story.
That's interesting fact.
Yeah.
The story you get
is
random each time, which bits of it you get.
Oh, okay. I only played it once through. And to be honest, looking at it in terms of replay value, there is none.
No. I don't really care enough about who Esther was and what happened to her at the end.
I don't even... Yeah, exactly. Now, that sort of doesn't surprise me in a way, learning that the narrative I was delivered was a pseudo-random set of phrases and set of paragraphs that come from a big old list somewhere.
I believe that there is an overall plot. Each chunk is randomly given to you.
Yeah.
So you may get one of six bits...
Yeah, okay, fair enough. And so over the course of, I took an hour and a half because I actually backtracked because I went down one path that didn't actually go anywhere and you end up coming back up.
I found that one.
You found that one, yeah. So I went back and on myself and there.
I really felt rewarded for having gone down that path.
Yeah. And you're seeing all these sort of enigmatic scribbles on the walls and stuff and weird things here and there. And obviously, as you're playing through it, both the narration and also occasional bits and pieces you find as you're moving along start to convince you that, hang on, this isn't quite what it appears to be. So I suppose it's the open to interpretation sort of thing going on. So, you know, things like hospital reports lying on the floor in this abandoned 1800s shepherd's shack from a hospital in London. You're thinking, oh yeah, and scan photos and so on. And I think there was a defibrillator sat in the wreckage on the beach of the trawler there, and you're thinking, oh, what's that doing there? So you're sort of picking up vague hints and vague sort of double meanings and ambiguities about what this actually is going on here. And you start to think, actually, I'm not really a bloke literally wandering around a Scottish island here, am I? There's some kind of inner journey or something happening here. I don't know if it's spoilerific, statute of limitations. To be honest, I think it's quite difficult to spoil.
Yeah, no, really, it's impossible to spoil. Go for it.
I'm not even sure it has a particular meaning, really. So you end up sort of wandering along the beach, and then you go into some caves, and there's a bit where you drop down. There's quite a lot of ledges that you drop off that you can't climb back up because you can't jump and you can't climb.
No going back.
Yeah, so it sort of keeps moving you forward in that sense. And so you end up dropping down into this massive sort of pool of water through a cave, and find yourself in this underwater reconstruction of a motorway junction with a hospital trolley in the middle of it. And you're thinking, wow, hang on, this has all gone a bit strange. And so at that point, it's quite clear that what they're trying to deliver is a kind of, I sort of interpreted it to be he was in some sort of coma, and this is all an internal journey that's leading to his eventual letting go of being in a coma and just letting himself die. There's a lot of hints about car crashes and drunk driving and so on, and who is Esther anyway? Was Esther also in the car? Is Esther his wife?
Actually died years ago.
Exactly. So he's writing this letter to Esther for want of a better person, I suppose, and it's actually an internal monologue about whimsy and regret and you know, struggling to let go of things, I suppose. It's sounding like I'm just not having any truck with it at all and I'm real Philistine, but it was quite affecting, and I did quite, you know, get caught up in the sense of melancholy and about it all and the whimsy and so on, but I ultimately found it extremely unsatisfying because essentially, okay, here we go, big spoiler alert, but your big journey across the island is towards this radio tower you see in the distance at the start, and you've got no real choice about going there. You go there, you climb up to the path, you get to the top and you think, oh, wow, excellent, I'll be able to stand on top of this hill and have a good old look around at this. No. Yes.
I'll be able to stand on the top. It's going to reveal the entire map around me and all the other events that I have to do.
See, I'll be able to jump off into the hay cart and now I know where all the game is. Yeah, no. So as soon as you get near the radio tower, it takes over into essentially what amounts to a cutscene at the end, which is climbing the tower, jumping off, and not quite hitting at the bottom, but actually going off and flying across the water, and then it fades to black, and then it sits there and doesn't do an end credits and doesn't do a game over. So I sat there for a good 10 minutes of black screen with the noise of the waves waiting for something else to happen, because I on some level couldn't quite believe that that was it.
Something happens at 11 minutes.
That's tough. Too late. I'm gone. Got things to do. Ultimately, I came away from it all thinking, well, that was interesting.
That was arty.
It was very, very arty. And I don't want to call it pretentious because that just makes me sound like I'm some sort of village idiot hick. But I like my art to have a little more substance, a little more intent, you know?
Well, you see,
this is a creative thing. This is not a procedurally generated random thing like No Man's Sky and, oh, look, I happen to have accidentally come across a really cool looking thing because that's the way the numbers have fallen. This is an act of creation which has an intent. Somebody has sat down, some chap at the Chinese Room, I don't even know what the guy's name is, but someone sat down and wrote this to tell something, and I still have very little idea what he was trying to convey. And I'd hate to think that he was the sort of git who I'd absolutely detest in the arts, who is a git that deliberately sets out not to tell a message and then lets the viewer go and hang themselves with their own bit of rope, as it were. Ah, well, no, everyone finds their own meaning in it because I hadn't put any meaning in it at all. That's essentially trickery. That's a sort of betrayal of trust between creator and viewer, I think. But I don't know, perhaps I was just a bit dense and didn't really get it. I don't want to say that I was annoyed by it. I found it quite moving, quite interesting. And
the island is lovely.
Very whimsical. Yes, the island's lovely, but I don't know.
You've been in that kind of landscape, maybe not in the Hebrides, but...
Yeah, Dartmoor, Exmoor, that sort of thing. Some parts of the New Forest are like that. I've been wandering around in a sort of cloudy sunset that sort of perpetuates the island. Then when it moves to the night, it's a very well put together visually, and you know, the audio, the sounds, the visuals and everything. It's an interesting and nice place, but it's so frustrating because you want to really explore it. You want to get off that railroad.
What is over that hill?
Yeah, exactly. You want to, and you want to be able to interact in some fashion as well. Pick up a rock, put it down, throw some pebbles into the water. There's a whole load of little paper boats near the end, which is some kind of metaphor for passing your wisdom down the ages or something, I don't know, and you know, you wanted to just push them around and play with them a bit. There's like candles along the path at one point during a night section, and you know, you, It's the difference between being in a computer game, which is what we've come to just sort of come to understand is how we interact and work in a virtual space in an imaginary world. Things like Skyrim, yeah, okay, it's not about the guns or the swords or shouting "Thrum" at dragons and stuff. You know, it's about having a realised and interesting different world to explore. And there's no exploration with this. It is like staring at a painting. The fact that you use the WASD keys to push the narrative forward a little bit is almost irrelevant. It is not an interactive experience in any meaningful sense. It's just and then the narrative and the story writing is so full of ambiguity. I mean, obviously, who wants to sit down and play a game where a bloke goes, "I was in a car crash, it was really bad, my wife died," the end, you know? I mean, okay, so you dress it up, you give it a bit poetic license and so on, and that's nothing wrong with that, but at the end of the day, you're still left with essentially what amounts to, you can complete. I accidentally pushed shift tab when I was playing. I bought it through Steam, and so I was looking on the Steam interface. No achievements,
no,
because that would imply objectives and intent. But in the community section side there was a video by X someone someone XX, and it was speedrun, Dear Esther speedrun, and I just found that concept hilarious. Because essentially, if you just kept pushing forwards in the obvious direction it wants you to go and don't let off the forward key, that is your speed run. Yeah. I don't know if
unless you can glitch through.
It might be some glitch through scenery, but so, and you can probably get this whole thing finished in an hour. And I don't want to come back to this reductive. Oh, games should have X amount of kilojoules of entertainment per Tesla of pounds spent or whatever, you know. But for £7, I mean, you're bordering on a movie, a feature film, and it's not even long enough.
No, it really does feel.
It's not 2 hours.
The problem I have with it,
yeah,
is you come away feeling that it is something that was made just for the sake of making it, because it could be made, not that it was made for
that.
A reason.
I respect that someone just wants to make a thing, but what I sort of don't like is how this has become the archetypal cornerstone of an entire genre of Dear Esther likes, which probably aren't even as clever or as involved.
No, there's an awful lot.
And now people feel that they can get away with that as a game.
There's an awful lot of games which are like that, but then there's all these other ones which are included in the term walking simulator, which because of Dear Esther completely do not fit.
Yeah. Well, look at the Solus project that we were talking about a while back, and that's on Steam sale. So you should probably not on Steam sale by the time you listen to this, but yeah, I recommend that. But that was functionally, I mean, I played the Solus project before I played Dear Esther, and I can see in it sort of, I can see its origins. The Solus Project was clearly designed with Dear Esther in mind, the basic fundamentals. I mean, Solus Project is not a thrilling action shooter fest by any stretch. It is essentially a walking simulator, but there's the introduction of gameplay elements such as your environment monitoring, keeping hot, keeping cool, that sort of thing. And the simple use lever to progress through puzzle or choose different ways to get around this problem. You know, those sorts of things transcend, you know, move it from what this thing is, and I'm still struggling to have a definition.
If you look
into what is a game.
If you look at the other games which have been included in this term, like Gone Home or any of those ones, they all have a narrative or something going on which makes them
more
interesting.
Firewatch thing?
Yeah, Firewatch. Mm. Very much the same. You're walking between lots of locations, but there is stuff going on. You feel at every point
There's
that you have a purpose.
There's a definite niche, definite thing this scratches, which is, you know, almost a kind of meditative, I just want to wander around an interesting audiovisual experience for a bit. It's almost like a sort of, I don't know, screensaver type of thing, but with limited interactivity. But, you know, if someone asks me, is Dear Esther a game, I will go, no, of course it's not. And, you know, I can pick any number. You give me that look, and I know you want to have a nice, nice, solid argument about it all. But there's some very fundamental, empirical things you can point out that Dear Esther does not have, which games do. An objective, a lose condition, a win condition, opponents. You know,
I don't think any of those are needed. What I think it lacks is enough substance to be worthwhile.
It should be itself, but much longer and with a much, much more in-depth and coherent story.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if it's a game or not. What matters is what it is. And what it is too slight. It's too shallow.
You can get the wrong end of the stick with the is it a game debate, because it's coming to it from being a gamer. If someone tells, you know, if you ask the question, is it a game, and someone says no, then that can be wrongly construed as a kind of criticism. So when not everything has to be a game, it's okay.
True.
If
yeah.
things are not games. I mean, I kind of liked Dear Esther in some ways, but I had such a large amount of expectation about it all that it was quite difficult to unpick all that and try and approach it for just what it is.
I think just as the walking simulator thing is very, very damaging to the discussion of what these games are.
Well, I mean, you could have a discussion about whether Steam tags are useful in any meaningful sense, but
I think the what a game is this or is it not a game, is just as...
It's an experience. It's,
yeah, exactly. It's just as damaging.
But as an experience, I probably still would want it to be more substantial, more intricate, more interesting in ways. I mean, you know, I remember playing Half-Life 2. There was a freebie download, Lost Coast, which I think essentially was like a kind of demo level for the new lighting model.
HDR lighting and stuff.
That felt very much like this, except in Lost Coast there were some antlions and things to shoot at as well. But, you know, it felt... The Dear Esther thing, it feels like taking some tech and doing a little interesting thing with it and then trying to perhaps afterwards. I often wonder, I was looking at that and wondering, did the island come first or did the story come first? Did someone just do a really interesting Hebridean island and think, now can I make this meaningful or substantial, this tech demo I've made?
And importantly, can we ever know the truth of that now, considering...
Well, no, because you obfuscate it in smoke screens of, true art is uninterpretive, you know, or true art has no meaning or whatever. And again, you get this whole, it's art, so it's now beyond criticism. And this sort of almost reluctance to call it shallow or call it not interesting, because that would just then expose you as some kind of philistine and proper critics get it, you know. And I
really enjoyed walking around the island.
I did too.
It's a really nice place to be.
Yes, and I was constantly sort of grasping for meaning, scouring the place, looking for clues. And
I think that's the problem.
And there wasn't really.
You expect something to be within your grasp and it's never there, and that is just an ultimately disappointing,
unsatisfying
way to end a game where you've been thinking, is something going to happen that's going to make this all mean something?
It wasn't necessarily that I was looking for a happy ending. I wasn't expecting him to wake up from his coma and be surrounded by his family. A sad ending would have worked too, but the sort of weird bit with the radio mast at the end and the flying across the water and just, you know, random stream of consciousness.
It felt like, although with much less class, that they got to the end of making this thing and thought, we don't have an ending, quick, get Terry Gilliam to do an animation for it.
Well, no, I didn't even get the sense at any point throughout the thing that it was even attempting to tell a story and then ran out of time. It was just whimsical fragments that sort of somehow had something to do with being in a car crash, you know? And you're sort of desperately trying to piece it together, and perhaps that was the intention. If so, I find myself resentful that I was made to do it.
Mm. Yeah, it's one that I think has to be played.
It is odd. Yeah, I would recommend looking at it, but, you know, don't be prepared to be disappointed with how poor value for money it is.
It's very well worth playing, and I think everyone should play it to some extent, but you are going to come away disappointed.
It's interesting but unsatisfying. Yeah, strange.
It tried something, and I think it proved what shouldn't be done in many ways, but it needed to have been tried.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so an odd thing. I mean, it's not that I'm just, you know, dismissing it out of hand. It's not rubbish, but it is odd. And some sort of defies categorization, which is part of the problem, which is why my lumping it into categories of walking simulator and all the rest of it tend not to be useful. But I can't see me wanting to play it again necessarily, because I don't think there's anything else there.
No, you just get different bits of the story, and who really cares?
I'll go find a walkthrough on YouTube or something.
No, there are other ones that are laughingly called walking simulators that you should
That's
try
the
next.
Problem, is that this was elevated well beyond its proper place and taken as some kind of template for a whole genre of games, I call them games, genre of half games, I suppose. You know, suddenly you can get away with just doing making a level and then having some sort of pretentious narrative of being voiceovered at you and ship that as a game. You don't have to play test or balance or come up with kind of conditions or difficulty levels or objectives or anything like that, because true art is incomprehensible or something.
I think there are the next game you should play.
Yeah.
In this kind of thing.
Yeah, I've got that big list of your stuff.
Yeah, you should probably do Dr. Langerskov or the Stanley Parable.
Parable was on your list, wasn't it? Yeah.
Which is something with more writing. Or Gone Home, which again is something with more writing.
Oh, that was it. The Bridge, Ian Banks, The Bridge.
Yes.
Have you read that?
Yes,
you
I have.
Read that,
not
dear
since
listener.
The 80s.
You may not have read that, dear listener. This is Ian M. Banks' his non-fiction, well, it's his non-culture, non-sci-fi stuff. So he also wrote a whole load of contemporary fiction under the name of Ian Banks. And one of those was the thing called The Bridge, which is a real sort of, really, I found that fascinating and really enjoyed that. It was a sort of, again, a sort of ontological mystery. Bloke wakes up on this weird sort of city that's built across this mass, built into the workings of this giant suspension bridge type thing. And he goes about his life trying to piece together why he's lost his memory and who these people around him are and so on. And that sort of goes on and develops on further. And I probably shouldn't spoiler it, but it's a very similar kind of underlying story, but much better told, much more intricate and much more satisfying.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if that was the kind of story that was trying to be told here, it really didn't do a very good job.
The problem with Dear Esther is you don't know if it was a lack of budget, a lack of talent, or a lack of not wanting to do that in the first place, which is why it doesn't feel satisfying. Do they just not have enough budget for enough voiceover to put more in?
I don't know, but it doesn't feel like it's hard to tell what direction it was trying to strike out and achieve in, but it doesn't feel like it really got in any direction all the way, you know?
I think it got all the way in doing an island.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
That was the best representation of an island when
it came out. Very nice island. Hey, yeah, how old is it now?
Oh, it must be 5 years or so.
So for a five-year-old game, that's a very, very intricate and detailed landscape. But comparing it against Skyrim today, I think you'd probably, there'd be much of a muchness.
I would not compare it against Skyrim. I would compare it against The Witcher.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the first Witcher.
No, The Witcher 3.
Okay. So it's a very detailed game for its time. But
you look at The Witcher 3 and then you look at that, and The Witcher 3 just looks so much better than it, but was done on a much better budget with a lot more time.
Yeah.
And this was a small student project which turned into
an indie game. Oh, like, no, lower your expectations because there's only one bloke made it, that kind of thing, but I don't know. I honestly, coming away from it at the end of it, not really knowing if I liked it or not, and for various reasons. It's not that it didn't make any kind of impression. It's that it's very difficult to come up with an average impression, given all the good things and bad things about it. You know, it's quite divisive, I imagine.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear comments from listeners who've played it and see what they think as well. Because I honestly, I don't know what to think.
Yeah.
So someone please tell me how I should feel about this game.
Play the Stanley Parable next, and we'll have another discussion on the next.
All right.
We're playing
about
how that one differs and what that does differently.
Yes.
And how it succeeds and fails.
There clearly is a larger conversation, a larger ongoing movement in design here that this is an example of, and there's a whole genre of these sorts of thing about there now. Games that aren't games, simulators of walking, that kind of thing. What does this mean? Is this where games go?
More importantly, it is, I think, and this is a very broad brush, but games which don't use combat and killing as the primary language.
I was watching some. Oh, all right, okay. So I went around to visit my mother the other day. We had Chinese takeaway, watching some telly. I can't remember even what we were watching now. I think it might have been old episodes of QI on Dave or something. But the adverts were coming up, and there was a whole bunch of Xbox games on there.
Yeah.
And it was all just explosions and guns and people blowing stuff up. And
I was
just sinking into the seat when Mum goes, "Oh, you play these games?" Yeah, yeah. You know, it's that conversation trying to explain your hobby to a normal person. I don't bother anymore. But it really is an embarrassing thing, seeing what gaming looks like from the outside. It is essentially big slabs of meat firing guns and blowing
it still
stuff
looks
up.
Like it's targeted at 14-year-olds.
I think it might have been Titanfall 2 as one
probably.
Of the ones, but they might have been Mafia 3 as well. Or
Titanfall, that Mafia, there was probably Call of Duty as well.
Yes.
That's in heavy
Battlefield
rotation.
1 was
Battlefield
on the
1,
adverts as well. And that looked like some horrific glorification of the horrors of the First World War. Tell me that's not what that game is about. Okay, he's gone silent. No, moving on. This is my problem. I'd love for gaming to be such a varied thing that Dear Esther is as representative of what we do as Battlefield 1942.
That's why I love these things and really like this type of game
but
as a whole.
This kind of thing has to hold together and work as a game and be popular and successful.
But
otherwise, we're just going to be playing Gears of War 37 again
and
cringing every time TV
adverts. This was the start of the journey, and it's done an awful lot of damage with that walking simulator term. Because whenever somebody else tries anything close, people just slap walking simulator on it, and then people think, oh, it's just like Dear Esther.
That's not a game, yeah.
It's
moving
just
on.
Wandering along a fixed path, occasionally getting a bit
of
profit.
I don't get to blow anyone up in this.
Yeah.
Moving on, yeah. That's a shame. Oh, well, anyway. So, yeah, there's definitely more to be said here, but we'll do that another time. Stanley Parable, you say?
Yeah, Stanley Parable next.
I'll fire that one up next.
Okay.
We'll reconvene. So, over to you.
I'm going to talk a bit about LEGO Dimensions again.
Okie dokie.
I've been playing a bit more of that. In fact, I was playing it in two-player.
I'm seeing you got the A-Team Fun Pack there with B.A. Baracus and B.A.'s Van. Look at that.
That is fantastic.
That's solid, isn't it? That's well built.
Yeah. A nice little build for the A-Team van there.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. I was playing it multiplayer with my girlfriend, and because, you know, it's one of those LEGO games.
Yeah.
So you can just play it with two controllers.
Very good couch gaming stuff. Yeah.
Only it's not.
No.
There is a fatal flaw in LEGO Dimensions when it comes to multiplayer.
What's that?
Building the damn LEGO.
Oh. Wow.
Building LEGO is not a co-op experience. So you decide, like this one. We needed somebody with strength to to pull a handle and open a thing. So I thought, right, I'll open the A-Team pack.
So your friend has to just sit there while you spend 20 minutes
following instructions on the screen, building the A-Team van.
Yeah. Should you not have built it previously? And
no, because the instructions are in the game. The moment you build BA, you put him down, and then instructions come up, and everything stops.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. And that's fine if you're on your own, because you just push pause, or the game will wait for you, and you do a bit of Legoing.
You've got the very pleasurable activity of making Lego at that point.
Yes, but it's not something you share.
Yeah, no. Watching someone making Lego may not be that fun.
God, are you done yet? Hurry up. Yeah, oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, and also, when you're in multiplayer, you don't notice it in single player, but in multiplayer, it is buggy as anything.
Really?
Yeah, there's something with all the timings of the
things.
You'd
expect Lego to be of high quality, because generally their physical products are.
Yeah, stuff like somebody will start doing something, switch between characters, and that person will get stuck.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's just horrible, horrible bugs, and it crashed multiple times.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's just hideous. But
you'd expect better from a Lego-branded merchandise.
The overall game is still fine. Something I have noticed, which apparently is an issue with an awful lot of games at the moment, the audio quality sucks.
Oh.
The samples of people talking...
They've been backwards and forwards through conversions quite
a lot. No, they're quite low quality. And I was thinking, it's been sampled from film. So,
someone just hold a smartphone up or record during a film.
But then there's original stuff done by... proper voice actors.
Yeah.
Because, there's nothing in Adventure Time when Finn's talking to somebody from any of the other properties. So that has obviously been recorded specially. And the quality sucks. It's really low quality, echoey bollocks.
Well, imagine they're having to push this stuff out at a fair old rate, because there's a lot of it. Maybe they just really don't spend a lot of time finessing this stuff. It's a bit of a conveyor belt.
No, it's not so much finessing it. It's just putting it into really low quality audio and shoving it in instead of putting it in high quality audio. It could be a size thing, but yeah, it's really starting to notice.
Well, if the whole lot's got to be downloaded every time you plug a new bit of Lego onto the base plate, the whole lot's got to come download from a server somewhere. Perhaps they have to compress it quite heavily keep it playable.
No, it's one download. You put it on the first time and it says, do you want to download this? And you download it all.
Well, even so, you want to keep that download to as minimum as possible.
But it's
compression.
It's just one of those things which is a bit awkward. There's issues with the new Skyrim Special Edition, apparently, where that too has got bollocks audio on it.
Oh.
There's something going on. I don't know what it is.
Somebody's stealing our audios. Probably aliens.
I'm going to blame Sony, because I experienced this on a PlayStation. But no doubt I can blame Microsoft as well.
Fair enough.
So that's really odd. But the game is still solid. I was still poshing through the Ghostbusters world up until the point it crashed, and I thought I would do a bit of the Adventure Time world instead. So we went through the Adventure Time world, which is always a fun experience when you're playing someone who doesn't like Adventure Time and doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And you have to...
There's an
awful lot that when you come to look at Adventure Time from the outside, you think this is a little bit weird.
I'm not really, don't know Adventure Time at all.
Yeah, but then it got to the point where that crashed too, and just thought bollocks to this. And
that's terrible. Don't buy Lego. Boo.
Yeah, no, it's really, really unreliably buggy at the moment, and it's unacceptably buggy.
Is there an expectation of patching?
It will get patched, but
just need to kick up a fuss on the right kind of forums.
I don't think enough people are playing the multiplayer for it to be turning up with enough priority to fix. Because I wasn't getting these troubles in single players.
A reasonable number of people to see it for the signal.
And also, it does... The multiplayer is split screen. But for the last couple of games, LEGO have done this thing where there's this diagonal line which moves around the screen, and
So
you basically just get two sides, but it's dynamic.
Gosh. No. And first, first rule of bad UI design: leaping elements.
It is absolutely hideous.
Don't do that.
You just walk across the screen, it'll flick around, and then you won't know if you're on the left or the right. Yeah.
No, that's a terrible UI design thing.
No, it is really, really
bad.
You
should never have bits of the UI that leap around into different positions randomly or for different reasons, because it's just very confusing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's my rant about Lego, really.
Fair enough. I'm going to talk about Guild Wars 2 we're still playing.
Okay.
We're doing a bit of pottering around, doing some levelling this week. We've done some dungeon work. We're doing the Ascalonian Catacombs, the Tuesday Noob Club there. I think we tried some fractals as well. I don't know what the deal is with that. So fractals is like your alternative reality snippets of the main game world, where different things have gone wrong instead, or bits of history or whatever. There was something very similar at the end of City of Heroes. There was some insane portal corporation who kept buggering about with alternative reality snippets of worlds, just that you can play about and see what happens if the bad guys had won, that kind of thing. It's like every Mirror Universe episode of Star Trek. Anyway,
yeah.
So there's that kind of thing in Guild Wars 2, and the fractals are interesting. There's basically a series of repeatable dungeons, and they run from levels 1 to 100, and you get a personal fractal level based on how far up this sequence you've got, and each one is a different dungeon. I think there's perhaps 20 or so actually different dungeons, and then they repeat in higher tiers with this agony debuff that means that you have to have better gear and so on. So I'm still in the 1 to 20 range. I think my personal fractal level is 2, because we did fractal number 1, which was interesting enough. I remember us trying fractals when they first came out a couple of years back, and they were insanely difficult, and we got nowhere with any of it. So I don't know if they've tuned them down a bit, made them a bit more accessible, but they definitely seem viable. And interestingly enough, they auto-level up, which is something nothing much else in that game does, apart from the world v. world things. Which means that we can potentially do dungeons whenever we like, totally irrespective of individual personal progress. Because we've got some people who've gotten on faster than others. There's some wildly variable rates of experience gain in there, depending on if you're an old-time player with 100 buffs going. I mean, I'm still running on birthday bonus buffs from character birthdays. So I'm pretty much running around with 100% bonus XP all the time, and I tend to be leveling up quite quickly. And then, depending on if you throw yourself into the large events or whether you're just pottering around doing the soloing stuff, depends on how much XP you get, and of course obviously how much time people want to actually put into the game.
Yeah.
So, and it's fine that it levels everyone down, but it never levels anyone up, so it means that dungeon thresholds is something we have to sort of chip towards, so that we can get full teams together to go and try these various dungeons, which you can only go into when you're the certain required minimum levels that work your way up
through
the game. A bit of a throwback to old school MMO design, when the rest of the game doesn't really care what level you are at all, which is a shame, but we're getting there. I've been pushing on with the Heart of Thorns story quests, which are trying to explain what the hell all that's about. It's apparently a doomed raid into the Maguma jungle by the Pact, who are so successful dealing with the dragon of the main base game content, the Zaitan ore stuff. That's all done. So this big air fleet gets utterly womped straight away. All the Silvari go mad and get possessed and start fighting the friendlies as well, which is nice, because I'm gotten a bit sick of the Silvaris being the big Mary Sue can do no wrong race in this milieu. It turns out they're all very easily corruptible by Mordremoth, the jungle dragon, who's the big bad in the Heart of Thorns content. So most of the Silvari are sort of under this big cloud of suspicion. Everyone's afraid they're going to turn on them any minute. The big airship push crashes, loads of prisoners taken, lost in the jungle, lots of exploration, finding new villains and new allies and so on. There's some really difficult gaming going on in the Heart of the Thorns zones, though. The Verdant Brink and the Ulric Basin, and I've not got to the other bits yet, but there's such hard work in there. I don't know. I mean, it's a game that it is a game that its fundamental core is terrified of its players getting bored. So this tends to manifest in a constant go, 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 do these events. Here's a waypoint to this thing. Go here, go do this. Hey, look, now it's an event. Now it's Halloween. Here, talk to Mad King Thorn. There's lots going on and very little place to just stand and, take a breath. But that also manifests in the moment to moment combat gameplay of the game as well. And basically, if you are standing still, you are playing Guild Wars 2 wrong. They're afraid of players standing still and doing hotkey rotations, so pretty much every fight from like Ore onwards involves tumbling out of the way, big red circles you're not meant to stand in. It's like doing sort of traditional dungeon boss fights in a normal MMO of 10 years ago, but every yard trash encounter is like that. They've all got knockdowns. They'll charge. They'll fling you over the place. They'll beat you to the floor. A lot of the stuff in the Maguma jungle areas will basically one hit you if you don't get out of the way. I suppose we call this action gameplay now. See, everyone's terrified of doing the oldie stand in one place and work through your rotations type thing. That's why there's no Trinity, very little in the way of healing other people abilities. They want you to all be running around like crazy blue-ass flies and trying to get your rotations done. There's some interruptions to be had there, but generally, on the whole, you've got to keep moving, got to keep on the move, and that gets really tiring after a while. Certainly Auric Basin, a lot of the encounters in there, you can sort of just about get by solo if you know what you're doing and work really, really hard all the time. I think a lot of it probably is designed more for duoing or groups or whatever, but I don't know. I'm sort of pushing through. But I've also then gone and kicked off the Living World 3, which I think is the current thing, which is Rising Flames, which is all about Ring of Fire. This is an area from Guild Wars 1. It's all volcanoes and fire monsters and Primordius, the big dragon of flames and magma and stuff. The trouble is I've got these running side by side, parallel. So I've absolutely given up any hope of trying to put together any coherent narrative in that game because of what they do with their time-limited expansion-type content, the Living World. Living World is their big name for their project where they're trying to keep it interesting, trying to keep big events going all the time, and this is quite significant, and it does live up to the hype. I mean, during the course of the Living World 1 season, which would have been about 2 years ago now, they actually wrecked the main player hub city, made it off limits, so everyone had to go and use temporary goods and services out in a nearby zone, and then they rebuilt the thing with an entirely newly designed zone and put it back in, and there's lots of festivals and events going on around it all. So, you know, they really they're really not afraid to mess their world up and change it in significant ways. And trouble is, there's a reason most MMOs don't allow you to have any kind of impact on the world or change the status quo and just do a sort of hand wave, invisible nod to continuity. Because how do you make a story where a player can change the world in a world where there's 10,000 players or whatever? It's a difficult thing. So what they do is it's a lot of instant stuff, a lot of story mode things. But so everyone's on different parts of a story that has different sort of impacts on different parts of the world. So anyway, Living World 1, you got the base game with its own internal story, which is about fighting Zaitan and saving the world from the undead dragon and the Kingdom of Or and so on. That's all very good, all quite self-contained. Hooray, at the end of it, all done. And then you think, oh, now what? Living World 1 was a massive thing where an evil rogue Silvari called Scarlet Briar went insane and started sort of just having a massive go at the civilized world and wrecking whole zones and so on. And that was apparently a lot of fun, but I wasn't there because I'd gotten bored of the game at that point. And now I've come back and you cannot play Living World 1 story. It is gone. You had to be there, basically. It's not available anymore. So I've now detached and come off of the story because I was, when the game launched, I joined in and we were following along and it's all good fun. And then I took some time away and for my disloyalty, I've now been punished by not having a bloody clue what's going on with the narrative or caring about it in any meaningful sense anymore, because it's nothing to do with me, this Living World, because I missed a load of it. Living World 2 I missed, which was a whole bunch of stuff where I think you got to fight off Scarlet Briar and then Dry Top and the Silver Wastes and some extra zones and things. I don't know. And that was a lot of lead-in towards Heart of Thorns, a build-up for Heart of Thorns. But if you weren't there for that, you can buy that in the cash shop. You can pay a big bunch of gems, their microcurrency, to have the part two of the Living World unlocked and made playable for you if you weren't there. If you were there at the time and dabbled in any chapter and unlocked any of it at the time, it's there and available for you all the time. But if you missed it entirely, you've got to go into the cash shop and go and buy it. I don't know how much for, but a whole load of gems, probably 5 to 10 quid, probably. Something like that, I expect. So that's now put me rather apparent. And then, of course, Heart of Thorns came along, the big expansion. That's essentially a whole load of story and content that you go out and pay an expansion box price for. So that was 40 quid's worth.
Yeah.
Although, if you didn't have the base game, you got the base game free and everyone kicked up a massive fuss. Oh, these people didn't get... I paid twice. And these people who are coming along now and you got the expansion and get the game free. Yeah, but you've had like 3 years of presumably enjoyable gameplay experience, but I couldn't be sure there. So anyway, now there's this Living World 3 thing, which presumably is the business to do with the Mersat and the White Mantle and the Ring of Fire and so on. people from the first game will recognise a lot of that. And this looks to me like it's an interim content drop that's probably gearing up for another expansion further down the line that probably hasn't even been announced or anything yet. I'm just guessing at this point, but I'm imagining there's some kind of massive Elona-type expansion coming. But there's a sort of sense of fear and panic now that if you don't make a start on this Living World 3, which is currently available for free, they'll put that behind gems in the cash shop as well. Yep. So now I've got two different stories going on, and the Living World 3 is a massive spoiler for things that happened in the Heart of Thorns main game content as well. It's like, oh, so-and-so's dead. Oh, God. Oh, right, okay. You know, because basically you're now joining the story downstream from all the stuff that's going on in the Heart of Thorns. But of course, if you don't spoiler it for yourself, you're going to miss out, because by the time you get there, it will have been stuffed away in the cash shop probably. Yeah. So yes, I don't know. I mean, to be fair, they don't charge a monthly fee, but then that's not really so much of an excuse in this modern MMO age, I don't think. They certainly are well invested in microtransactions and cash shop currency this time around. I think that was probably the big mistake for Guild Wars 1, so they didn't really quite understand how to do that kind of thing back then. They've definitely compensated for it now. But it's fine. You can play without paying. You can convert your in-game gold into in-game cash shop currency in a manner similar to Star Trek Online as well. So if you're stubborn and penniless like me, then you can do it that way. I don't mind. It's all good enough. I'm enjoying it, but yeah, really ramping up the difficulty as they go. And it seems to me a classic example of game design dictated by the ultra hardcore.
Yeah.
You know, it's oh God, these players have finished it already. We better make sure the next stuff is difficult enough to keep them entertained. And, you know, woe betide any casual player isn't that great. I found this fantastic thread on Reddit looking for hints and tips on builds and how to adjust my expectations and gameplay style to the newer content. And it was basically the original post was a massive rant about the game's far too difficult, and then it was followed by about 400 learn to play. Yeah,
yeah.
You know. And I just thought, if any of you wankers could have just put a paragraph or two about build strategy, then perhaps we would be living in a nicer world where everyone was happier. But no, it was like 300 people going, get good. And you just think, well, thanks for that. That was really a worthwhile use of typings on a keyboard and internet bandwidths and so on.
We're that step closer to the end of the universe because of it.
And I can't wait. Everyone deserves it. So there you go. But on the whole, I'm enjoying my time in Guild Wars 2, both in terms of Tuesday New Group and soloing as well. I'm playing quite a lot of solo time in there as well. I've got three different characters on the go. interesting to see how the elite specializations are working for each of those. I'm starting to get the hang of the Chronomancer, but I think Mesmer in general is probably one of the classes that's very much the most impacted by the if you stand still you are playing it wrong type gameplay style, and you've just got to keep dodging and tumbling and moving, because if you stand still something's going to one hit you, which is very much like real life, I suppose. Yeah, I find. Yes, so there we go. Anyway, Guild Wars 2 still going well, still doing fun in there, despite all my ranting.
Okay.
Over to you.
Right, you talked about Mafia 3 earlier on.
I mentioned it briefly.
They're being adverts. Yes, yeah. Well, since that was coming out,
yeah.
I decided that I had got Mafia 2 in a Steam sale many, many years ago.
I remember you talking about that on a long ago show.
I played it on Xbox, and then I bought it on Steam, because I bought a lot of my Xbox games on Steam and Steam sales, because why not?
Mm.
And so I started playing Mafia 2 again.
Can't remember what you thought about it. You thought it was a competent, also ran in the Saints Row GTA type.
And I still feel that. Yeah. Some bits are better than some of the other games. Like the driving is better than GTA 4's.
Okay. Oh, everything's driving's better than GTA 4's.
But the driving in this game still sucks.
GTA 4 driving drove me off that game. I did briefly try and play it, and that just drove me straight away.
Yeah, in Mafia 2, the driving is so bad that if you speed, the police come after you. And
well, it is a sort of five-star wanted type game engine type format,
yeah,
I imagine.
But you have to obey the traffic laws too much, which is really, really dull.
Well, that's real life, isn't it?
When
it's realistic.
You to travel across the city, you have to obey the traffic laws, and screw that.
Hmm.
But luckily it's easy enough to evade the police or get to a firefight and then just walk away.
Well, yeah, I suppose if you just murder all witnesses, then it's fine.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird design choices in the game, which don't quite... The driving thing, that is not a fun design choice.
So on a sort of sliding scale of the grim drudgery of ultra-realistic Saints Row 4 versus the bonkers over-the-top Saints Row the 3rd and 4th, whereabouts
is it? Did you just say Saints
it?
Row 4 is really, really ultra-realistic?
No, that's the opposite.
Okay.
So you got this spectrum where... look, you work with me here.
Okay.
Saints Row, bonkers.
Yeah, no, it's not bonkers.
GTA, too realistic.
It's more 70s film version of 40s gangsters
okay.
than just oh so po-faced and grim.
But you're not going to be flying around in a jetpack blowing people's heads up with an alien ray gun.
No, you're driving around in 40s cars in the 40s doing stuff.
Okay.
And, yeah, and the cars don't drive that well. It's all snowy and icy at the start, so of course you... can't really turn that well, so the driving was terrible. And you know, the combat's okay. I seem to remember it being slightly annoying on the controller, the shooting, but it's better on PC, of course. Anyway, it's a competent game. The weird inclusion of Playboy images is a weird choice, and I'm not entirely sure why is one for any other reason than we can license this.
Oh right, proper trademarks and everything.
Yeah, no, it's got Playboy covers and things which are collectibles, which is weird because it's all ones from the 40s. So it's
this is the sex cards from The Witcher.
Well, no, it's not. It's sort of like that, but you know, it's Playboy's from back in the day, so it's slightly less erotic than the Beano.
Risque 40s thing. Going
there, there are more scantily clad ladies on the cover of the Radio Times nowadays. Yeah, anyway, it's a weird choice, and somebody obviously either wanted the license so badly or realized that somewhere along the line
maybe the license is really cheap and no one had thought to ask. Oh, look, for an extra $1,000 we could put Playboy in here. Okay, why not?
Yeah, don't forget, since this came out, of course, even Playboy have stopped doing scantily clad women in their magazine.
I only read it for the articles.
Yeah, that's all it is now. Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird game, and I still don't understand how it got a third one, because the game isn't quite good enough really to justify having a sequel, but it's still got one.
Well, it could be that we had this property knocking about and we got a whole new team and a whole new engine, we can sort of take it and run with
it's enjoyable, and I like it.
Have you played the third one?
No, not yet.
Okay, fair enough.
No, I thought I could pay for the third one, or I could play the second one, which I already have, and then wait for... I've developed this horrible problem.
Yeah?
I can't be asked to buy games anymore.
Oh, that's probably the end of the show, then. Well, the day I get bored of MMOs, we'll both have nothing to talk about.
Well, no, it's fine, because I'm just going back and playing all the games in my Steam library.
Nothing wrong with that.
You know, Civilization 6 came out, and I thought...
Well, I've got Civilizations 1 through 4. Yeah, I could play 5. Any of those.
Yeah.
You got 5, yeah.
Yeah, I thought I could.
I didn't like 5, I don't know why. Didn't click.
No. Really, I just thought I could play it, but I'm not going to have time to play it, so I bother buying it. Which is an interesting way to be thinking about games.
Well, this is how I've always looked at games. I've always thought, every time I buy a game, a previous game that I already own hasn't gone away. So I'm basically just, eventually, it's going to tend toward no spare time and no need to buy any more games ever at some point. I'll have got more than enough games to just keep going round and round my old games and never needing anything new ever again.
I think about the 500 unplayed games in my Steam library need to be addressed.
Yeah, it's a question of value for money. It's a question of using what you pay
for. On my plus side, the Halloween sale, no buys.
Yeah, well, there's a Steam sale on, is there? There's a surprise.
Yeah, I didn't need to buy any, luckily. Which is good. Yeah, no, Mafia, anyway. Yeah, it's an interesting, good game. It's worth a play, I think. It's quite fun and reasonably well written, and stuff happens, which is always an advantage over
stuff
safety.
Happens. It's got one up on Dear Esther, yeah. Wow.
But yeah, no, I like it. It's fun, but it really is that, you know, a second-rate game that we don't get that often anymore. And I'm sort of tempted to play Mafia 3 more to see if it is, because having looked at... One of the ways you can tell how well a game's done is by the way the price has crashed in the weeks since it came out. And it appears to be getting quite cheap already. So I think Mafia 3 may well be more of the same, in which case it's probably not a bad thing.
Yeah, if you like the original thing, more of it. So it would be more refinement, more tweaks, more interesting side stuff, I suppose. But who knows?
Yeah, and a completely more interesting plot with a big note about racism at the start. Which is always interesting, because games don't like to touch upon these things very often.
Can be awkward, yeah.
And if you compare it to, say, GTA, which so thinks it was touching upon it, but GTA actually has no social commentary of any worth to give. It just thinks it does.
Well, I mean, we've talked before about GTA 5. Trevor, is it?
Trevor, yeah.
The Nutter, who essentially is a sort of in-game injection of an out-of-game metagame personality into the setting of that world. It's just fascinating. But yeah, probably not what they meant.
No, definitely not. And finally, I'm just going to mention that Galaxies of Heroes game.
Oh, yeah.
That Star Wars one on the phone.
Oh, yeah.
I've developed an interesting problem with it.
Yeah.
It wants me to do too much per day.
Oh, wow. You don't have enough time in the day for a phone game.
Yeah.
No, bad design.
The problem is, well, it's got to the point where there is a list of daily activities you do,
yes,
which is do X of these missions, X of those missions, start a Galactic Civil War, play three arena matches, upgrade a mod, level up a character, yada, yada, yada.
That's a bit of a problem for a game that presumably charges you real money to have more actions and more things to do.
Yeah, but you've got too
many things to do before even spend money.
There's enough. That just covers your basics.
Oh, right.
Everything you've got. And there's enough there. You can get a good hour's worth of play out of this per day. Unfortunately, it wants an hour. If you want to play optimally, it wants an hour of your time every day. And it's beginning to feel a little bit like it wants too much of my time.
Yeah, which is kick it weird. Out. It's not the boss of you.
Yeah. The other problem is, you know when you come across a mechanic that you look at it and you just know, I know why this mechanic was added late into the game.
Yeah.
In this case, it's called mods.
Mods?
Yeah. The mods are ways to modify your character.
Oh, right. So it's not actual user submissions to gameplay.
Consider Eve implants. Basically just the same thing.
Okay, yeah.
Or you can take them out again. Well, in this case, they were obviously added in late into the game.
Yeah.
To deal with the complete problem with the cash flow. Where there must have been way too much cash. Because, boy, are these things cash sinks.
Okay.
And so
They've done their maths wrong, and now everyone's swimming in in-game
money. Yeah, so they add something which is desperately needed to be able to play competitively anymore.
Yes.
Which just eats up all your cash. And it is so obvious as to that's what happened, because, boy, are these things
Guild
expensive.
Wars 2 has the luck mechanic they added sort of halfway into their run, which basically when you get loot by the bag load in the new Heart of Thorns thing. Literally, your inventory fills up after one trip out there, one meta event, and it's just too much loot. So, and that obviously has a deflationary aspect on the market, and they pride themselves on having hired a real economist like what Eve did. It doesn't really show, to be honest. He's not a very good economist, I don't think, if that's the case. But so they added a mechanic where you can salvage the loot for materials, and this dust called luck dust, basically magic dust that you consume, which will basically then increase your magic find percentage on your account.
Yeah.
Permanent increase. And it's a diminishing returns for each new percentage of. So basically, what you do, and I do this, mostly I do this because I can't be bothered to muck around with an auction house. I just destroy all my loot and turn it into a slightly higher percentage of getting better loot in future. And it destroys thousands of gold's worth of game items constantly. Very, very clever. Well done. Yes, you've got to watch your economy.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway, yeah, so I'm still continuing with that, but I don't know if I'm getting near the end of it.
It sounds like it's being a bit pushy now.
It's just that feeling of wanting to play optimally, but it's giving me so much to do per day that maybe if I want to get the optimal amount, then yeah, maybe.
Yeah, getting quite close to a screw this, I'm off type.
Yeah.
Point. Yeah.
I begin to think there's absolutely no middle ground on a mobile game that I'll be happy with. So, yeah, that's it for my games.
Right, well, I'm out of stuff to talk about as well. So, do your spiel.
Okay, you can go along to YouTube where you can give this a like, please, if you don't mind. And then you can also subscribe to the show to get more episodes.
If you want to give it a dislike, I'd invite you to talk to our customer service department first.
Actually, dislike's better than no like.
Notoriety and stuff.
Yeah. You can also go along to howtomurdertime.com. We can find all the previous episodes, including the Van Hemlock podcast, which may be getting an RSS feed soon as the moment I finish doing it.
Oh, wow.
So you can go back and listen to all those shows easily.
RSS, that's pretty cutting edge.
Yeah. I've been working on a new games, a new site for the show.
That.
So,
that's going to be awesome when you unveil it.
It's going to take years, though. And also, go along, take a look at our Minecraft videos. We actually made progress in the videos we recorded this week.
Getting quite worried that we're going to be finished sometime this next decade. Yeah.
If I could find the bit of paper I had, I'd actually written down all the percentages of what we were doing, but I can't find it.
Oh.
And a lot of them are getting close to 100.
Wow.
Yeah. Join us next episode when we'll be talking about something else.
See you later.
Goodbye.